From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We live in bubbles, says sociologist Arlie Russell Hochschild. She decided to climb out of her own. For 5 years, she dug into conservative, white, working-class Louisiana, got to know pipe fitters and plant operators and accountants and more to understand why people believe and feel the way they do when it comes to politics, how their anger, frustration, distrust has set the stage for Donald Trump. This hour on Point, sociologist Arlie Hochschild gets to know the American right. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Can you see, empathize beyond your bubble? Can you understand the view that drives your political opposite? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Arlie Russell Hochschild's new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, a journey to the heart of our political divide. Let's just get a little of the sound in our ears that might have been like what she heard in Louisiana. First, here it was a rally, a Trump rally in New Orleans in March. Arlie was there. Here's Donald Trump talking about the subject of his speech.
The horrible subject is our country is going to hell. The good subject is we're going to make America great again.
Arlie Hochschild was there. There are a lot of others thinking about Donald Trump over these weeks. USA Today talked with a bunch of them. They talked with Pat Acciavitti, 77 years old, from Michigan, talked about what he sees at stake in this election. Give some interesting insight why he's supporting Donald Trump.
If we're going to become just another country where the government is basically the babysitter, or if we're going to become a country that shows self-efficiency again, like it did when I was a young man. The country I grew up in is definitely not the country I live in.
There's a man of 77 looking at that with USA Today. Here's Carrie Truitt. She's 19, from Mississippi. Why is she supporting Donald Trump?
I support Donald Trump because he is supported by so many working class Americans, like the people who work for their money. They work hard for their money and they don't just want a handout. I mean, he also has supporters who, you know, are rich or who are poor, you know, but the working class Americans are his main supporters and they work hard just like he does. And I think he'll work hard for our country to make America great again.
And here's Joe Pitassi. He's in New Jersey talking about himself and Trump.
He's a businessman like myself, who has struggled probably a lot to keep his businesses going. And I think it's high time that we have someone in the White House that can understand the way the business world operates and make it part of the governmental part of our country to make it operate.
Arlie Russell Hochschild joins us now from Seattle, sociologist, professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. She spent much of the last 5 years in southwestern Louisiana talking with conservative voters. Her new book about her time there and her insights gleaned is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, a journey to the heart of our political divide. It's a finalist for the National Book Award. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Arlie Hochschild, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here, Tom.
This is a beautifully written book. I want to compliment you on that. And also on your empathetic outreach here. You went a long way from Berkeley, and you made a deliberate decision to climb what you call the wall of empathy to try and see things from a different perspective. A lot of Americans would benefit by that exercise. But what do you mean by the wall of empathy, Arlie?
Well, I was trying to take off my own political and moral alarm system, you know, really just to try and get to know people. And I met some amazing and really wonderful people with whom I had very fundamental differences, but who were just as interested in climbing this empathy wall as I was. I mean, I would come and say, hi, I'm from California, it's a Democratic state, and I kind of live in one political bubble. I'd like to get to know you and in your political bubble. And they'd say, yeah, we've been way divided, and we're upset about that. Thanks for coming. And in fact, they would say, you know, we're the flyover state. Nobody cares about us. They here in the South, they think we're just backward and kind of regional, don't understand anything. They think we're racist. They think we're homophobic and sexist. And they just They don't care about us and they don't know us. So it really was an amazing experience for me and a wonderful one to kind of get to know people in a very different enclave, in a different truth. You know, I went there kind of perplexed about the red state paradox. How could it be that the poorest states, the states with the worst education and medical care, the lowest life expectancy, who get more money from the federal government in aid than they give in taxes, hate the federal government? What's going, how, if you got problems, wouldn't you want some help? That's what I went with. And Louisiana was kind of an exaggerated version of that because it was, in 2014, the poorest state. 44% of its state budget came from the federal government, and it was largely Tea Party and has overwhelmingly gone for Trump. So I thought, okay, I'm in the right place to try and understand what I really don't get.
People opened their screen doors to you. I mean, you came and said, hey, I'm a sociologist from Berkeley, and they had a sense of humor. They would joke. You've got Mike in there saying, oh, so you're a communist right away. But then he opened up right. to you pretty well.
Yes, yes. So yeah, a little Southern hospitality was, I was grateful for that. And so, you know, I went with my paradox, and I would kind of just say, look, gosh, what about the government? Why don't you like it? I mean, doesn't it give you something? And yeah, well, it gives us the I-10, I guess.
And the I-10, the highway.
The highway. And there'll be another long pause. And I'd then say, well, how about the safety of your food? You know, oh, yeah, well, that, you know. So it kind of went like that, like they were proud to be, to imagine themselves as independent of it, although virtually all of these Tea Party enthusiasts used one or another major government service. Some who had parents with long-term disability and didn't have long-term disability insurance would register their parents in a certain way so that they seemed indigent and mm-hmm. were on Medicaid. Mm-hmm. This was not uncommon. So, but they were ashamed of it. There was, instead of saying, hey, this is the government's doing work that I want it to do. So I guess what I realized is that when I put that red state paradox to them, they knew about it and they were ashamed of it. You know,
ashamed of the amount of federal aid coming in because of the amount of poverty, you're saying, for starters.
That's right. They didn't like having, they made jokes of it, kind of dark jokes. Oh, gosh, we're the worst in medical care. We're the worst in education. And they knew it. But something else was more important to them. That was my discovery. And what that was is what I came to call the deep story. In other words, under politics, both on liberal and conservative side, I think there are underneath it kind of emotional deep stories. So what's a deep story? You take the facts out. You take the moral judgments out. It's life as it feels to a person. And for the people I got to know who became Trump supporters, the deep story is you're waiting in a long line as in a pilgrimage to the top of the hill at which there's the American dream.
Okay.
The line isn't moving, and you've been waiting a long time. Your feet are tired. You don't begrudge anybody, but you're waiting. You feel a high deserving for it. Your reward. And then you see some people cutting in line as you experience it. So who are they? They would be blacks with affirmative action who now have access to jobs that used to be reserved only for whites. Even more, women on affirmative action who now are able to get jobs that were formerly reserved for men. And then immigrants and refugees. Some people saw even the endangered brown pelican in Louisiana as standing ahead of them in line. One person said, now, you know, these liberals put animals ahead of people. So they then saw in this deep story, as they imagined it, that Barack Obama, representing the federal government, seems to be waving to the line cutters and sponsoring them. And then they thought, oh, he is their president. He's not my president. I'm invisible. I'm pushed back in line. And mm-hmm. that was a kind of a moment of estrangement from the government for them. They saw it as an instrument of their marginalization. What, of course, they weren't looking at is what was going on at the American Dream, the automation of the big multinationals that were taking jobs away from everybody, and importation of foreign labor, which I saw in the petrochemical plants around Lake Charles. So they were in this deep story, kind of riveting their attention on others, and that seemed to be getting ahead, cutting in line. And then there's somebody ahead of the line that turns around and says, oh, you redneck. And then that does it. Then they feel like strangers in their own land. They feel invisible. They feel insulted. And they are facing what many men in this country since the 70s, a loss in wages due to economic forces. So that in a way, for 4 years, I felt like I was getting to know people that at that Trump rally, I began to see, wait a minute, I've been studying the kindling. And now here at the primary rally in New Orleans, I'm seeing the match that lit the kindling.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with a Berkeley sociologist who stepped outside her bubble to get to know the American right, the angry, white working class American right. We're looking at who she met, what she learned. My guest is Arlie Russell Hochschild. Her new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. She calls it A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. With us today from Seattle, you can join us as well. Do you step out of your bubble? And what do you hear when you listen? Do you get it? Do you get the other view? Do they get you? Angry right listeners, do you hear yourself seen and heard in the observations of Arlie Hochschild? And liberal listeners, are you ready and willing to listen, to learn here? Arlie, you write, you say you'd come to Louisiana with an interest in walls, not visible physical walls. But it was empathy walls that interested you. An empathy wall is an obstacle, you write, to deep understanding of another person, one that can make us feel indifferent or even hostile to those who hold different beliefs or whose childhood is rooted in different circumstances. Have we given up on that? I mean, there have always been different political perspectives in this country. Do you think the walls are higher than ever, Arlie?
Higher than they've been in a very long time. Certainly in my lifetime, I don't remember a more tense, anxiety-soaked election. And people, have very strong feelings if they have to defend them. But, if you're out in a boat fishing with someone and you've had a beer and you're kind of talking about how this has happened, you've kind of got a friend there who's kind of a co-sociologist with how do we get into this? Mm-hmm. And, for example, this Mike Schaff, who I interviewed, who was a very strong Trump supporter, worked in oil all his life, born on a sugar plantation. Mm-hmm. I begin the book talking about that. And
he tells you, I'm pro-life, pro-gun, pro-freedom to live our lives the way we see fit, as long as you don't hurt others, anti-big government.
That's right. But you know what? I ran into, there's anger, but there's also mourning and sadness. It's a little easier to feel angry than it is to feel sad and a sense of loss. Mm-hmm. But when you really get down to getting to know the people I came to know, there is a sense of loss and yearning. And he felt that his community, that he's very enthusiastic about retaining this kind of small Cajun community, Bayou community. And indeed, that came to an abrupt end when there was in Bayou corn sinkholes, it's now called. The whole community had to evacuate because of an industrial accident of a drilling company that was underregulated. So I'm asking my friend, well, how about that? Wouldn't it be better if the government had really regulated that a drilling company and you wouldn't have lost your community? It wasn't the government that took your community away, but the absence of it in a way. And he kind of, yeah, you know, we could get to some kind of agreement, but we also agreed that the state government that he was in was not doing that, and that it was a state kind of captured by oil. And in a way, the state was doing the moral dirty work for the companies by pretending to protect the people, but not really doing it. So I understood why he resented paying taxes to a state government that wasn't doing its job. But he agreed with me that actually it was the oil companies that had bought off the state. So you can
and
see how...
And on came the sinkhole and down went the community. Arlie, can we go back to the mourning? You're writing about, your subtitle here is Anger and Mourning.
Right.
On the American right. And then you say that's because of his community's loss. Now, never mind the sinkhole, and maybe some regulation on the drilling would have helped on that. And that's a big physical deal right there.
Yeah.
But is he mourning the loss, you say, small Cajun community? Is that the loss of ethnic or racial separation?
Yes.
Is he mourning the fact that he has to deal with the diversity that is a fact in this country now, or is that too hard or a response to what you're describing?
I think we, in a complex way, yes. I would say that the people waiting in line for their just reward in the deep story feel pressed in many ways, and they feel a mourning for many losses. On the one hand, many were highly religious, and they felt that they were living in an increasingly secular culture. One man said, oh, you can't say Merry Christmas anymore. You have to say Happy Holidays or even just Happy. So he felt mourning for loss of that. There were others who felt the loss demographically, you know, of Christian whites. We're going to be a minority. Our whole culture is going down. They felt that the law of the land and the whole culture had moved away from them, leaving them to under the aegis of a number of epithets. One woman, a gospel singer, told me, well, you know, people in your political bubble over there in California, you think a person like me is sexist and racist and homophobic and maybe fat. She felt, you know, even Michelle Obama's garden program was kind of imposing rules on how she looked and how she ate. So,
but is it possible that
they felt colonized and a mourning for the culture that had been before?
Is it possible that she was sexist and racist and homophobic? And I don't mean that in a dismissive way, but that she preferred a culture that had old-fashioned gender roles, that she preferred a culture even where races, you know, knew their place, to go back to a Trevelyan thing, or didn't accept the kind of new understandings of gender identity that have become widespread now.
Quite right. But, you know, taking race, which was the big one, I felt, almost nobody wanted to talk about it. And looking around, I could see it was everywhere. You had the Jefferson Davis Bank, and, you know, you had statuary. It was pretty obvious, but people were afraid of being called racist. But now if you got down to talking, you'd get something like this that was more nuanced. One man told me, you know, I'm a reformed bigot. I said, what do you mean by bigot? He said, well, a bigot is someone who uses the N-word and who hates blacks, and I'd never use the N-word. I find it offensive. If someone says it on my Facebook page, I eliminate them. And I have never hated blacks. So, and I said, okay, well, how does that work? How did it work, the integration in your school? He said, well, in my sophomore year at high school, there was one black, and by my senior year, half the class were blacks. I asked him, so did you make any new friends? And you know what his answer was? Mm-hmm. It was, you're making me think. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's a man in process. And he also said on this fishing trip, you know, I want to live in a society in which color just doesn't matter. And with blacks, I think we're half there. So it's more complicated.
Maybe it's a matter of time. It's the passage of time, how much time this takes. Maybe some people feel too hustled here. I don't know. Or maybe there's a deeper resistance there. The new book is Strangers in Their Own Land. And Arlie, we've got a lot of callers for you. If I may go to E, calling from North Augusta, South Carolina. Hi, E. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. You're on.
Okay. Super. Well, I'm going to be one of the outliers for your guest because I am a white person who is very angry. But I think I'm angry for very different reasons than what she's been describing.
Okay.
I am horrified and disgusted at and furious at the fact that we as a nation, despite and maybe because of having a black president for 8 years, have not made it past the vicious and just unbelievable racism and sexism that we live in this country, particularly the way that police officers are killing black people in terrifying numbers for virtually no crimes often. I'm just shocked that we're still doing that, and I feel like the problem is that so many people were angry at getting a black person as president, that they've basically gotten worse in their racism than they were before, because now it's been brought out in the open instead of being something that festers in their deep subconscious.
E, let me ask you then, are you sympathetic? Are you glad that Arlie's gone out and listened empathetically to people who may feel some racial unease, may hold even some racism? Is it right for her to go out as a sociologist and listen empathetically to try and figure that out?
It is right. And I guess I should have said in the beginning that I'm happy that somebody is listening to people with a kind of a compassion for their position. And I what I hope is that being listened to helps them to evolve as human beings to a place where they don't feel the kind of vicious racism and revengeful or vengeful racism that, you know, seems to be personified in the followers of Donald J. Trump.
E, we've got it. Arlie, how do you respond to E's? She's angry and white, but you hear the vector of her anger.
I love her word evolve, and I think that's exactly what has gotten stalled. I feel like we've stalled in the conversations we could be having to pull people forward, and that's what I think we're in a reverse motion. I agree with your caller that there's a kind of a consolidation and a hate that you see, but we need to go underneath that to the fear and the mourning and have conversations such as I've just described that pull people forward. What we're seeing is everybody's bad angel, but I'm here to say that there are also good angels, and that the minority we're seeing I don't think representative, certainly of the people I got to know. And we all need a kind of a general national conversation about race that hasn't yet taken place.
Arlie Hochschild's new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Let's go to Maria in Miami, Florida. Maria, you're on with Arlie. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. Again, like the lady who spoke before, I guess I am an outlier as well. I am an independent. I voted for Barack Obama the last two cycles. And I, too, feel like I am in mourning and in sadness, and I do feel like I am walking as a stranger in my own land. I fit a lot of the different demographics. I am an exile refugee from a communist country. I have participated in the gay community since the 1970s. I have tons of friends of every color and every stripe. I lived in New York City for 14 years. But what I see is a big manipulation and a division purposely tooled and orchestrated. I don't see that this is organic.
But a manipulation toward what? Tooled by whom? Toward what, Maria?
Division, divisiveness, like putting it all on race and putting it all on this or that. And I just see it in a different way.
Who are you voting for? Who do you think you'll vote for this time out, Maria? I'm trying to gauge where you're coming from or headed.
I've done a lot of praying. I am an independent, so I'm going to withhold on that final thought. But I'm listening to both very carefully. And I think what people really want is they want jobs, they want progress, they want health, they want happiness. And I don't think that we're speaking to any of these things.
Are you leaning now conservative or liberal these days, Maria?
I am leaning very human. I am in a humanistic position because I don't first, and I've been independent, always have been, because I am a political immigrant. I'm a refugee. So I've already lost one country. I know what that feels like. There's things that we don't talk about. Abortion, ripping babies out of your womb. That's not liberal or conservative. That's a reality. I see that we're not speaking truth. We're like speaking all kinds of strange things. I don't see that race should be such a big deal. Really don't. I don't understand. And I do feel like a stranger in my own land, again, because I've already lost one country, and I feel like very unusual and uneasy about this situation right now.
Maria, I appreciate your call. Arlie, you write that economic self-interest is never absent from the conversations you had, but you say what you discovered was the profound importance of emotional self-interest, a giddy release from the feeling of being a stranger in one's own land. And I hear you kind of saying that Donald Trump, for many people, has been the agent of that release.
Yeah. Well, may I ask Marie what country she's a refugee from?
I think she's gone, but it sounds to me like Cuba.
Oh,
not sure.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, what's poignant is that now in this political moment, people on the liberal left as well as the far right can feel like strangers in their own land. And yet, you know, I began this book with one paradox, you know, the red state paradox, but I ended it with another, which is a paradox for people on the liberal side. Why is it that the Democratic Party that calls itself the party of the working man and woman is kind of losing people like Marie or independents by not speaking to them? You know, my husband and I were invited to give some talks in Hungary. This wasn't Cuba, it was Hungary, where Orban, who has become a quite fascist leader, as you know, was brought to power by the ballot box. And soon after he was elected, you know, the free press was suppressed, a power consolidated, and statuary changed to just show one ethnicity. And I asked, how did this happen? How could people vote a fascist into power? And people said that the left was turned in on itself, divided, and
Arlie,
didn't
hold
vote.
The thought. We're up against a break right here. When we come back, Thomas Frank will join us, author of What's the Matter with Kansas? And Listen, Liberal. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. talking this hour with a Berkeley sociologist who stepped outside her bubble to get to know the American right, the angry white American right. My guest is Arlie Hochschild. She's a sociologist at Berkeley, author of the new book, Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, A Journey to the Heart of Our Political Divide. You can join us this hour. Do you cross political boundaries in your life, right to left or left to right? And what do you see on the other side? Liberal listeners, are you ready and willing to listen, to learn? Conservative listeners, do you sometimes feel like a stranger in your own land, in the America this country is becoming? What would bring you home? In just a moment, Thomas Frank is going to join us. He wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, famously, and most recently the new book Listen Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. But I want to get one or two more calls here for Arlie, and we'll go to Thomas Frank. Vanessa in Williamsburg, Virginia. Vanessa, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you all today?
Just fine. What do you know, Vanessa?
So I am a white female, and I worked in law enforcement down in Metairie, Louisiana, in Jefferson Parish Sheriff's Office.
Outside of New Orleans, there.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the parish right outside of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And I found, now I'm from Virginia originally, a very diverse community. I grew up with many different races and was raised by a mother who, you know, you hate somebody because they hurt you, not because of who they, you know, what they look like. And what I found down there and what I believe is probably the number one factor for racism, sexism, there were so many problems, was the lack of education of other and diverse groups. You had, and I want to say that the majority of the issues that I had were with the white men. And again, I was a white female, but when I started making friends in the sheriff's department who were black, I was ostracized because how can you do that to your own race? I actually heard those words. And I found that if it wasn't anything like them, if it wasn't the same route that their life path was taking, it was thrown to the side and considered useless. And I find that the worst part about it was that they were not willing to open their minds, and they weren't willing to let these diverse groups in. That it was, and the only thing I ever heard them complain about, to the extent of their own existence, was, this isn't like what my grandfather had to deal with. This isn't like what my father had to deal with. And I think they were more upset about losing the ability to throw the N-word around, which I heard a million times. The inability to be in control of the women in their life, the inability to have all of those specialities that their grandfathers and fathers had, that's what they were angry about. It wasn't that the world is coming down on them. It was that they were losing the control that they seemed, because they were born white men, should have been allowed to have.
They're in Louisiana. Arlie, what do you say? Vanessa's got firsthand experience.
Oh, wow.
Police officer right there.
I just would love to sit down and interview your last caller. So interesting, so interesting. And I'm I'd like to interview the people that you are frustrated with who describe this. I think that is true, but I also think there's another story true for blue collar men, especially in the South, and one sees it. They're not doing well in school. They're not doing well economically, and there's a downward slide. There's a higher suicide rate and drug addiction rate, more divorces. There's a kind of a trouble that we haven't kind of named and caught and turned around. And one of the ugly faces of that trouble, I think, is prejudice.
But, you know, we've got an email here from Chuck who says, look, he's just not buying the whole premise here. You know, what a better world it would be if you're a sociologist and you could just convince us angry white men to see the flaws in our thinking, is Chuck's response. And he says, the conversation is predicated on this this is masquerading as the search for some deeper understanding, but it's actually kind of just trying to say you should be this way or that. He writes to us, I voted Democratic for 30 years, and yes, I'm angry, he writes, with a government that can't even perform basic functions like running the Veterans Administration. Is this gussied up tutelage of the other here,
well,
Arlie?
That would be what it was if you can't cross the empathy wall, and I many times fell down on the wrong side of it. But I would invite him to read the book.
Thomas Frank joins us right now via Skype from Washington, author, historian. He wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, which looked kind of at the paradox of the red states that Arlie Hochschild talks about. His latest book is Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, where he takes Democrats to task for losing touch with a lot of the working class. Thomas Frank, thank you very much for joining us today.
How are you today, Tom?
Well, very well. I'm glad to have you with us. And Arlie spent 4+ years as a sociologist looking at this and trying to bring some empathy to this and figure out what's going on with our political divide. What do you hear in what she's brought back, Thomas Frank?
I love the stories that she tells about meeting these people and their life stories. And they're fascinating, right? The guy that worked for the chemical company for years and years and years, and knows all about how the bayou was poisoned and that sort of thing. And then he's still like massively against environmental regulation. You know, there's something just absolutely fascinating about that.
Thanks.
But do you see a Democratic Party that should be listening more empathetically to this part of the American population that's just not hearing it, that for whom Donald Trump has been, as Arlie says, the match that sort of sets fire to a whole lot of frustration?
Yeah. So I have a slightly different way of looking at it, and I think we'll see what Arlie thinks of it. But when you read a lot of the grievances that these people express with the system, they sound like straight-up class class resentment, class grievance, whatever you want to call it. But the class in question is not the sort of capitalist class, the billionaire class. It's a different sort of adversary, and that adversary is the professional class. So I was just reading – I was just flipping through Strangers in Their Own Land. I read it earlier, but I was struck by one of the people that she talks to was getting angry about healthy food on the menu at McDonald's, you know, which seems silly, right? But you understand, like, he's objecting to the sort of this outside world that knows what's good for him, that knows what's and what he's objecting to is professionalism, the rule of the highly educated, of the people that know better than you how everything should be organized. And this is sort of how I don't know if you remember this, but this is how What's the Matter with Kansas ends, is that you can find with – What's the Matter with Kansas is I studied a state that's not Southern, you know, both because I grew up there and also because I wanted to get away from, you know, the problems of the South. You know, those don't really interest me all that much. But when you – what you find there is people signing up for culture war issues. It's always some different aspect of the culture wars, and they're so passionate about it. And what you find when you scratch the surface of every one of these culture war battles is class language, the language of, you know, of class anger, that people who are, you know, elites, who are powerful, who we didn't vote for, who have this sort of unexamined, you know power over the rest of us are telling us what to do. We good, honest, you know, people here in Kansas. Okay. So then, you know, here we are 12 years later, and I decided to write about the Democratic Party. And what do you find in the Democratic Party? That they have, in the same period that we're talking about here, from the late 60s up to the present, the Democratic Party has deliberately shifted its focus from working class people to the professional class. And they talk about this openly. This is who the Democratic Party is. They aren't the party of the people. They are the party of people with advanced degrees. I mean, they're not the party of the working class. Yes, a lot of labor unions still support them. And yes, they have other demographic groups that are part of their constituency. But the number one Democratic constituency these days is professionals. That's who they answer to. That's who they think about. That's the class position that
you describe that as a big mistake, Thomas Frank.
Well, it depends on how you look at it. I think it's a big mistake in the sense that this has permitted things like, you know, the sort of unquestioning acceptance of free trade deals that have been massively destructive for most of America, but good for professionals. or you know, any number of other policies, like not enforcing antitrust laws, for example, on Silicon Valley, or doing all of these favors for big pharma at the expense of the people that Arlie Hochschild writes about and that I write about. And so they, you know, and I mean, you can go down the list. There's many examples of what I call liberalism of the rich. But that's what we're living with now. It's a form of liberalism that really is not concerned with these people and their problems.
There's a brand. Well, let me just say, people's backs up. Yes, Arlie.
Yeah, that what Thomas Frank has just said is fantastic. I think it's really insightful.
You cite him important. Throughout your book and very admiringly. I want to get a caller in here again from Louisiana, where people are listening very closely. Scott's calling from Metairie, the same place where our Vanessa, our former caller, previous caller, once worked as a police officer. Scott, thank you very much for joining us. You're on.
Thank you. So I found your last caller really interesting, and I find myself in a better position as a white male who just moved back home to southern Louisiana, Metairie, finishing up my PhD in chemistry, but I have a brother who's a police officer here.
Okay.
And I very much see what she was talking about when I look at the surroundings around me when I'm here in Louisiana, of this desire to still maintain this control and inability to change from the people of, you know, the white males that I'm around. And I'm amazingly progressive. I was a Bernie Sanders caller and trying to get people to vote for him and everything like that, while my brother, who's a police officer, is a Trump supporter. We can't even talk about politics because it turns into quite nasty yelling, screaming, and maybe him wanting to be violent kind of matches. So it's very much there, and there's this divide, but not everyone falls into the Trump side of the divide. Some of us can't stand it.
So what do you do with that, Scott? Arlie has come all from Berkeley to be empathetic. You've come home to your brother, and you're having trouble mustering empathy, and he's your brother.
Yeah, I don't like the spewing of hatred and xenophobia and the inability to accept that everyone's human. Everyone wants to see the differences in people, and you know, we have massive problems in the South down here where I'm from with racism and sexism and all that. And I have two little girls, and one of my best friends is black, and I see it, and I see what they go through, and I worry about my daughters and what they're going to be raised in. And I have a PhD in chemistry. I want to be an educator, not just in science, but also in, you know, how the world's changing and that people are people and we have to, you know, help each other out whenever we can.
Scott, I appreciate your call very much, sir. Arlie, what do you do with this picture then? Is it possible that some of these difficult, faces that we're staring into here are motivated by the kind of what Thomas Frank describes as elite liberal policies that don't really care about the working guy, and so they aggravate all kinds of resistance, including some that's giving Scott and his brother a lot of difficulty.
Yes, I think Tom's on to something very important. I think it's a heads up for the Democratic Party that it's too turned inward, and we really have to address these class differences, especially as rich get richer and poor get poorer. There's the 1% and the 99%, and that this is ever more urgent. And I was very moved by Scott's, your last caller's, a message about not being able to talk with his Trump-supporting brother. You know, I met a quite wonderful woman who's feels like she's backing into Trump support. She sells medical insurance to the guys in the plants around Lake Charles. And I went around with her to, you know, meet the people that she sold her insurance to. She's, and they're super Trump, blue collar super Trump. She's ambivalent Trump. Her son is for Bernie Sanders, and they're coming for Thanksgiving to Berkeley, California, and participating in something called Living Room Conversations. Something started by Joan Blades, the co-founder of MoveOn.org. Liberal website, and these living room conversations involve people coming together, breaking bread. You have Tea Party on one side, you have Progressive on the other, trying to take it kind of issue by issue gently. Maybe families need to do this too.
Is that the way, Thomas Frank? Can we settle this by having tea?
No, no. I mean, it's nice. We need to do that. That's part of it, and it's great that people understand one another. But the larger question that sort of underpins everything that we've been talking about here is this: the middle class of this country is coming apart.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
We can all see it, and we can also see that Wall Street got bailed out. And this is, the standing obscenity of this century, that until we come to terms with what we did or what our leaders did, we're never going to get to the bottom of this. Now, what Arlie was saying and what the caller was saying about people coming from the same situation, one of them becoming a Sanders supporter and one of them becoming a Trump supporter, that's the choice. Which way are we going to go as a country? Well, the fact is we're not taking either choice this time around. We're going to go for the status quo. But somewhere down the line, we're going to have to look this problem in the face. And I hope we take the Sanders route rather than the Trump route.
There's where Thomas Frank plants his flag. Arlie Hochschild this time out may agree. I was heading toward empathetic listening as you're the core ground you're defending this time, but you put your flag where you will. I'm glad you went. I'm glad you brought your report back, Arlie.
Places.
Okay,
yeah.
We'll try. Arlie Hochschild's new book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. Thomas Frank's new book is Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Arlie, Thomas, thank you very much to you both for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.